Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service for public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on war when we come back. Well, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we've been taught from the time we're children that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if your carpenter said he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Well, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or fix his own steps has to be incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law, a law school professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about lawyers, the young budding graduates from the law school. He said, it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed, and it's worse than that. Most of the students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said that a student can graduate without having set foot in the courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. And he concludes by saying that whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, it is a cruel hoax, unquote. That's Professor James Nielsen, Hastings Law School. Well, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, it's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. War. It's in the news every night. The war in Lebanon, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. And then there's the pending wars with North Korea and Iran. Now, if that's not enough to keep you awake at night, let's talk about this concept of war. It seems that everybody wants peace. Every time I pick up the newspaper, every time I pick up a news magazine, there'll be an article in there about peace. Condoleezza Rice, our Secretary of State, is shuttling back and forth between these protagonists in these various wars, seeking peace. They talk peace constantly. They talk about a two-state peace solution for Palestine. They talk about the insurgents over here and the need to avoid a civil war in Iraq. I don't know if they've got a civil war going in Iraq or not. I don't know what the official definition is, but they're killing about 100 people a day. And it's one side, it's the Sunnis and the Shiites, and they're fighting among themselves. And then they're fighting the Americans. And they're at constant war. You ever notice that? Now, I'm an old man. I've never known peace. There's been war. It started just 2 years after I was born, called World War II. In fact, if you want to start the war, it started in September of 1939. Hell, I was only a couple, 3 months old by the time World War II started. And then we got into the war in 1941. So there was this constant war through 1945. And then the World War II ended, and then immediately we started the Cold War. And we went through this Cold War, and we went through more than 40 wars between 1945 and 1970. In 25 years, we've been through 40 wars around the world. You know, we talk about peace, but we glorify war. War is a part and parcel of the American economy. You know, without war, our economy would collapse. That's how big war is, war and defense spending. We spend more money here in America on defense or on war and war preparation than all the rest of the nations in the world combined. So for Americans to say that we want peace is, to my mind, kind of ludicrous. It's insane. We don't want peace. We can't afford peace. Peace is not a part and parcel of our economy. It's not a part and parcel of our psyche. It's not a part and parcel with our national history. We have been at war. We've been fighting with people from the day our country was conceived in 1776. If we're not fighting the English or the British, we're fighting the Indians. And if we're not fighting the Indians, after we destroyed the Indians in 1892 at Wounded Knee, we went right out and started conquering the Philippine Islands and the Spanish-American War and Hawaii. And we took Puerto Rico and Cuba. Remember that little story there? And then we got involved in World War I. We've been involved in Latin America about 10 or 15 times. We're involved in Latin America today. We have military bases in Paraguay and Uruguay. We have military in Colombia. And we're talking about war with Venezuela. It's not too far off into the future here when we'll be at war with the Venezuelans. Now, regime change is a part and parcel of American foreign policy. We've been at this, for at least 100 years or more. And America is an empire builder. I keep listening to these guys on the news media, and they say America is not an empire builder. America is not an empire builder. Boys and girls, we have American troops stationed in 120 countries plus around the world. Hell, there's only 191 countries in the United Nations. Let's work that out. If you get 120, and divide that by 191, what percentage is it? 62%. I don't know if the Romans, at the peak of the Roman Empire, had troops in 62% of the countries of the world at that time. Maybe they did. I'm not saying they didn't. But if they did, then all that demonstrates is that we are a colonial colonizing power, an empire builder on a different scale than the Romans. That's all that boils down to. I don't know if empire is good or bad. I'm not here criticizing the American empire. I'm just here telling you that that's where reality is. And empires cost a lot of money. We're spending around $500 billion. That's $500 billion a year on defense. That's war, when war preparations. I saw the other day some numbers. There's about 12,000 nukes in the world. The Pakistanis have about 60. The North Koreans have 4, 5, or 6, they say. And the Iranians would like to get some. They want to join the club. China has 60. Picture that, 60. I think America has Russia and the United States together, I think have around 12,000 nukes, 12,000. And somebody said years ago, now I don't know how they figured this out, but they said that back in the 1970s, that America had enough nuclear capacity to annihilate all life from off the planet more than 10 times over. I think it was more like 30, but just be conservative, 10 times. And the Russians were at one half of that. They could only do it 15 times over. Let's cut it in half to 5. It seemed like to me that annihilation of all life from off the planet once is more than sufficient, isn't it? I don't know what the rational basis is for having enough nuclear capacity to annihilate life from off the planet 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 times over is all about. It keeps PhDs and scientists, and it keeps defense contractors working and keeps them employed and keeps money pumping into the economy. I think that's really the basic reason for all this defense spending over here. But we've gotten to a point, it would seem like to me, that just common sense alone would say, well, why don't you spend that money? Instead of hiring a defense contractor to make 30 or 40 more nuclear weapons, why don't you hire the same defense contractor, retrain him a little bit, and have him go out and fix the potholes in the streets of New York or cut the grass in the parks of New York or go out and do something more intelligent, more constructive that benefits you and benefits me? Because, if you got 12,000 nukes in the world today and you double that to 24,000, I'm not getting any benefit off of 12,000 nukes. I don't think I'm going to get any more benefit out of 24,000. And it would seem like to me if 12,000 nukes is good, wouldn't 24,000 nukes be better? Wouldn't it be better? And then they talk about this nuclear proliferation. My God, we don't want the Pakistanis and the Indians to get into an arms race. I'm not really sure that I understand why I'm concerned about the Indians and the Pakistanis in an arms race. I can understand the Russians and the Americans in an arms race because I'm an American and I'm one of the guys that's paying the taxes to build all these nukes that I'm really not sure what in the hell they're being built for. Like I said, I'm perfectly satisfied with enough nuclear capacity to annihilate all life from off the planet once. I don't think I need any more than that. That's the ultimate. Seems like to me that you've arrived. That's nirvana, isn't it? So when somebody's telling me about 10, 15, 20 times overkill, I'm sitting here saying, I think we can spend our money a little more intelligently than that. Now, I don't want you to write me a letter and tell me that I'm a damn pacifist over here. I'm not a pacifist. I'm all in favor of war. I think we need more of it. But, isn't enough enough? When is enough enough? Now, I'm listening to my politicians and spend my money, and they're telling me that they want peace in the Middle East. Listen, those people hate each other. I don't think they like each other at all. Now, I've been watching this Hezbollah thing and this Palestinian Fatah or whatever they're talking about. I'm not up on it like maybe the Secretary of State or the President, and I'm sure that they're probably pretty well up on it. But it comes to my attention that those Arabs over there hate the Jews, and there's a guy over in Iran, I can't pronounce his name, he's the President of Iran. He's calling for the destruction of Israel. He says we can't live over here with those Israelis. We got to destroy them. We got to annihilate them. And the Israelis, for their part, they don't have such a philosophy. They don't want to annihilate the Iranians. They don't want to destroy Iran. They don't want to to eliminate the nation of Iran and just blot it off the map. And they keep telling us that they don't have any desire to annihilate the Palestinians or to annihilate the Turks or the Lebanese or the Syrians or the Jordanians or the Egyptians. They just want to live in peace. That's all. They just want to live in peace. And I've been watching this, and my conclusion is the Jews over there, or the Israelis, are actually not Jews because they're not descended from Judah, but the moral of the story is that they're doomed to destruction. They haven't got a snowball's chance in hell. Just think about it for a minute. You're surrounded by 100 million Arabs over there, and not all of them. There's probably 10 or 15% that are saying, well, we could probably live with those Israelis. But you got about 80% of them over there that hate them, and they want to annihilate them from off the planet. And then conversely, the Israelis are sitting over there saying, oh, no, we would never think about doing that to any of our Arab neighbors. We just want to live in peace over here. Well, just stretch that out for 100 years or 200 years or 2,000 years, and what's the ultimate end going to be? The Arabs are going to continually work until they achieve their goal. They're going to work for their goal of destroying that little country of Israel over there and annihilating those people. And it kind of reminds me of the Old West. You know, the old gunslinger, he comes into the bar, and then there's this young kid, you know, he comes in there to challenge the old gunslinger. And the old gunslinger shoots him down, you know, and he puts another notch on his gun, and that's 38. And then another young fella comes in, and he challenges the old gunslinger, and the old gunslinger, he shoots number 39, and he puts another notch in his gun. Listen, boys and girls, it's just a matter of time until the old gunslinger gets killed. And he may win 40 battles. But you see, every time he gets into a firefight, he has to win every time. And boys and girls, statistically, the law of averages says that the Jews are going to lose once. And that's all it's going to take is once. You see, they have to win every single time. The Arabs don't have to win every time. They can lose 1,000 times in a row. They just need to win once. And any one time that they win, it's all over for the Israelis. So if you want to bet on the outcome of the Palestinian Israeli conflict, bet on the Palestinians to win, because that's the inevitable ultimate outcome. Now, that piece of real estate over there has been fought over before. It's not something new. Back in ancient times, back in the days, you know, around Moses and Joshua and the time of the judges and David and Saul and Solomon, there were wars going on over there in Palestine. Wasn't over the Arabs, but what difference does it make who you're fighting? You know, it's one gunslinger after another. And our people, the Israelites, had a guy working for them that we called God. And he did a hell of a job for us. He destroyed all of the nations that we came up against. All of them. And I got to thinking about that the other day when I was kind of looking at this new war over there in Lebanon. And just kind of mulling it over a little bit. And I said, you know, if God were running that war in Lebanon today, how would he conduct that? What's his modus operandi? Is there ever a time and place in history where it's been written down? Where a war went on, you know, say between the Israelites and the Egyptians, and whose side is God on anyway? That's another big thing. You know, you got Allah working for the Arabs over there, and so far he's not been doing a very good job. And then whoever the God of the Israelis is, he's been doing a hell of a good job, because the Israelis have been winning each and every time. And then so far, you know, they've won 1967, 73, and then you get up here into the Lebanese period. I think they've done six incursions into Lebanon. Is this the sixth one? And they're not doing as well this time as they've done in the past. Ordinarily, you know, the Israelis, they've got that war under control in 2 or 3 days. And now they've been at it for a month, and they're still over there battling on that. And those Hezbollah guys over there, they're really excited, because if they can stay in the game, they call themselves a winner. I mean, you're down, you're beaten up, and you're bloodied. And I guess you could do that. If you were fighting with Muhammad Ali and you could stay in the ring with him for 5 rounds, I guess that would be kind of a victory, wouldn't it? After he's beaten you half to death and you're bleeding all over and you can't see he's declared the winner, but then, you know, you say, well, I stayed in there for 5 rounds, and so therefore I got to be called the winner. That's where the Arabs are today. But as I pointed out, the ultimate end to this is that if the Arabs ever get the upper hand on those Israelis, I think they're going to kill them all. So I got to looking at the word war in the Bible. It's in there 224 times, pretty respectable number of times that God talks about war. Then there's warring, warreth, wars, and warriors. That's in there another 28 times. So there's a total of 252 times that we talk about wars and warriors and battles and one thing or another. Pretty respectable number. And then the word peace appears in the Bible 405 times. But it's not always in context with the end of a war. Sometimes the word peace is used for, go in peace, or peace be unto you, which doesn't have much to do with war. It's using the word peace in a different context. And when you look at peaceable and peaceably and peacemakers, it's another 21 times. So there's about 426 times versus 252 times. Some round numbers, about 2 to 1. About 2 to 1. And there's some neat statements in the Bible about peace. I looked that up, and in Jeremiah 6:14 and Jeremiah 8:11, it talks about peace, peace, when there is no peace. And I look in my news magazine, and they're talking about peace, peace, and there is no peace. And I'm an old man already, and there never has been any peace. And then in the New Testament, I saw a statement that said, the way of peace they have not known. That's in Romans 3, verse 17. The way of peace they have not known. And so I could testify to that. Yeah, I could come into court and testify, yeah, I've been around for 68 years now. Yeah, the way of peace they have not known. And they cry, peace, peace, when there is no peace. And the president's constantly talking about peace. I guess it's because we want peace, but we build nukes for war. I kind of wonder about that. I gotta ask, does it make sense to be building all of this nuclear and all of this conventional war material and to talk about peace? Wouldn't it be more intelligent to say, well, we're not building this stuff over here for our health. We're building this stuff to go to war. We're a warrior nation. We've been a warrior nation. We're an empire builder, and we are an empire, and we have to keep our empire together. I mean, that would be pretty honest, wouldn't it? Well, I read a story here the other day. I got to share this with you. You ever heard the name Smedley Butler? Smedley Butler. It's a pretty odd name. His name is Smedley Darlington Butler. He retired as a major general in the U.S. Marine Corps. He penned a book entitled War is a Racket in his later years after he became honorable. And in that book, he identified himself in the actions that earned him the Medal of Honor in the U.S. Marine Corps as gangsters in the service of the United States corporations, specifically Brown Brothers Harriman, Citibank, Chase Manhattan, and United Fruit Company. Now, General Butler retired in 1933. He had been in the Army for 33 years and 8 months. 33 years and 8 months, he says in his book. So he joined up right after the Spanish-American War, and he was in the Marine Corps from 1900 to 1933. And he was a lieutenant, and he worked his way up through the ranks until he became a major general. He won the Medal of Honor. And get this, he didn't win the Medal of Honor once, he won it twice. You know, not very many people can win the Congressional Medal of Honor. This guy won it twice, which, you know, goes with Marines. You know, those guys are tough nuts. There's no doubt about that. That's why people join the Marines, because they want to show everybody how tough they are. They're a tougher outfit. I was pretty impressed. And here's what he had to say. Now, I'm going to review his book. I ordered it the other day. I told the wife, I said, go get that book, bring it in here, and let's take a look at this guy, because he says that he was in the service of the United States Mafia, which was out here working for Brown Brothers, Chase Manhattan, and United Fruit Company. What was that all about? So here's what he had to say in brief. He said, war is a racket. It's a racket, as best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to be to the majority of people. Only a small inside group knows what war is all about. War is conducted for the benefit of a very few people at the expense of the masses. I believe in adequate defense at the coastline and nothing else. If a nation comes over here to fight, then we'll fight. The trouble with America is that when the dollar only earns 6% over here, then it gets restless and goes overseas to get 100%. Then the flag follows the dollar and the soldiers follow the flag. Now, I wouldn't go to war again, as I have done, to protect some lousy investment of bankers. There are only two things that we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes, and the other is the Bill of Rights. War, for any other reason, is simply a racket. There isn't a trick in the racketeering bag that the military gang is blind to. It has its finger men to point out enemies. It has its muscle men to destroy those enemies. It has its brain men to plan war preparations. And then it has a big boss, a super nationalistic capitalism. Now, it may seem odd for me, a military man, to adopt such a comparison. Truthfulness, though, compels me to do that. Now, I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of this country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general, and during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer. I was a gangster for capitalism. I suspected that I was just part of a racket at that time. Now I'm sure of it. And like all the members of the military profession, I never had a thought of my own until I left the military service. My mental faculties remained in suspended animation while I obeyed the orders of higher-ups. That's very typical with everyone in the military service. I helped make Mexico, especially Tampico, Mexico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped to make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank. For the National Citibank boys to collect revenues. Then I helped in the raping of a half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. The record of racketeering is long. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912, where I have heard that name before. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. Now, during those years, I had, as the boys in the back room would say, a swell racket. Looking back on it, I feel that I could have given Al Capone a few hints. The best that he could do was to operate his racket in three districts. I operated my racket on three continents. Possibly, what awakened Butler to a notion of true honor was what happened to him in 1933. As he testified to the U.S. Congress, he was approached by J.J. Raskobob, who was the CEO of DuPont and a representative of a number of like-minded plutocrats and industrialists, attempting to engage his services to assassinate the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Butler went semi-public with the details of the assassination conspiracy, but none of his hirers were ever jailed, and nor were they ever charged with a crime of committing a conspiracy to commit murder. And for the most part, citizens of America, this historical event has been buried, but it really happened, and you can look it up and maybe you can find it. What I found in the Library of Congress 30 years ago was that anything concerning this event has been removed. It's no longer available. I'll make a complete report when I get the book, but that's quite a revelation. Quite a revelation. A major general in the Marines writes a book, says war is a racket, and he says, let me tell you what they had me doing in my military career. Now, as I take a look at the war going on in Iraq, I see that Halliburton, you know, the multinational corporation, the big oil giant, Halliburton is over there making billions of dollars. Bechtel Corporation is making billions of dollars. How much does the average soldier make? You know, think about it. The average soldier over there is making a few hundred bucks a month, and Halliburton and Bechtel are making billions. And they're not the only ones. There are thousands of contractors. And the United States goes in, blows up a building, and then the contractors come in and rebuild it. And we call that the national economy. Excuse me, kids, but it seems like to me that there should be a more intelligent way to buy, sell, and trade and make money, make a living, don't you think? I mean, it's not bad. I'm not criticizing if that's what you want to do. I see the other day, the Jews are over there just bombing the hell out of Lebanon, and they're blowing things up. And the president of Lebanon, he says, well, we've got to stop this war because they've caused $1 billion worth of damage already. Well, you know, think about it in more pragmatic terms. The United States of America will go over there with our corporations, and we'll go to work and rebuild all that damage. You see, the Israelis go over and blow it up, knock it down. And then we go over there, and we build it up and fix it all up so they can come back and blow it up and knock it down again. It's kind of like a bunch of kids, you know, playing on the beach, and they build a little sandcastle, and then they come along and they bomb it to rubble, and then they build another sandcastle, and then they bomb it to rubble, and they, you know, that's child's play. Humans do the same thing. Of course, there's a little problem that comes in war called death, and a bunch of people get killed. And then that causes a lot of weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Have you been watching those Muslims over there when somebody dies? I mean, those people over there really take it hard. I mean, they beat themselves, and they cry, and they yell, and they scream, and their hands go up in the air and one thing and another. Now, I've been to a couple of three funerals, and my mama died, and my daddy died, and my granny and grandpa died, and I went to those funerals, but I never did take death quite as hard as those Muslims do. You know, a bomb goes off in Baghdad, and those people are running around in the streets, you know, with their hands flailing around, and they just, you know, they really get excited over death, and I really can't quite figure that out, because when you interview them, you know, the American news media goes over and they'll sit down with some Arab over there and they'll start interviewing him and they'll ask him, well, what do you think about this? And he'll sit, he'll brag to you about his kid, about how he's raising his kid over here to be a martyr for Allah, and that and how great that's going to be and how he's going to go to heaven and have 70 virgins or something like that. And then when the little guy gets killed, they just go to pieces. I mean, they yell and they scream and then they rant and rave and jump up and down, paw the ground, bite the bushes and get real excited. Americans don't take death quite that way. At least I haven't observed it over here that way. People get a little somber, you know. I mean, they don't smile and play, you know, music or something like that. They play pretty somber songs, you know, and people don't smile very much at funerals. But we take the body out and we bury it, and, you know, it's dead. And we bury it and we give it a proper burial. But that's what war produces, death, doesn't it? And then we got John Wayne. Have you ever noticed that? John Wayne, you know, he stars in a lot of war movies. Cowboy movies and war movies, and Americans are pretty violent people. We love violence. We wouldn't tolerate a movie, you know, if it didn't have some sex and violence. Sex and violence, that's what we like over here in America. We got to have people getting killed, and we like to have blood. You know, we like to see dead bodies in our heroes. You know, they triumph over their evil, wicked guys in black hats, you know, in the movies. And then John Wayne, you know, he comes charging up here, and he's just killing people right and left. And then there's what do they call that guy, Mugambo or Marambo or some Rambo. And he's over there in Vietnam. He's just blowing everything up and killing people right and left. Well, that's exciting. Well, it's real exciting as long as they're killing slant-eyed gooks, but it isn't nearly as exciting when you're bringing the body bags back to America now, is it? And people are starting to get kind of excited. Now, there's 2,500 Americans been killed over there in Iraq so far. But, you know, 2,500 is really just a pimple on the elephant's trunk. During World War II, they were killing people by the thousands. And in World War I, it was the tens of thousands. I mean, there was four big battles in World War I in which, in a single day, they killed 40,000 British, American, or German troops. 40,000 in a day! Can you believe that? There's four big battles in World War I, killed 40,000 in one day. And then, you know, you take these big battles like Normandy invasion, you know, and the Sicily invasion. I mean, they killed a few thousand every day. I mean, they killed more people than have died in Iraq in a day, for crying out loud. 8,000 died there in Guadalcanal, and another 6,000 or 8,000, you know, on Taro, and you know, each one of those islands out there, you know, killed a few thousand guys, killed more guys on those islands out there every time they had one of those battles than they killed in Iraq. So when it gets right down to numbers, you know, the Iraq war is actually going pretty well. Something to think about. I mean, we're producing billions and billions of dollars for trade, commerce, business, and industry, and there's only a few hundred guys getting killed over there. I can sit there and say, well, that guy Gordon's really callous. Listen, I'm just a reporter. I'm just reporting the facts. Now, Americans love war, and I don't understand the logic behind getting all of this excitement over here and voting Joe Lieberman out of office because he supports the war, which is what our economy is based on. Boys and girls, you take war out of our economy, and you people are going to be selling pencils on the street corner. I mean, let's be intelligent. I had a guy here one time. He came from, I think it's Lockheed Martin, the defense contractor. And he'd been listening to this radio program, and he said, well, I'm going to leave Babylon, and I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to farm. I'm going to go do something intelligent. It lasted for about 6 months, and he went back to New York and Lockheed Martin, where the money's at. And when he was here, he complained bitterly. He said, you know, my defense stocks, you know, I sold my defense stocks and bought gold. And now the gold's going down and the defense stocks are going up. Boys and girls, I never told you that defense and war isn't profitable. I mean, if you want to make money, you want to be investing in war. Don't invest in peace. There's no money in peace. You know, peace is like medicine. There's no money in health. The money is in sickness and disease and plague. That's where the money's at. The money is in bypass surgery. And there's no money in vitamins and minerals. The money is in separating trends, not selling zinc to prevent it. The same thing's true in the world out here. We're talking about war. You know, the money is in war. The money is in defense. If money is what you're after, you know, don't come out here and farm. You want to get out there and get in there with the defense contractors and new oil companies. But where is all of this headed? And where are we going with all these wars? And especially these wars in the Middle East. And for some of you religious guys out there, do you remember a story about Armageddon? Has anybody ever, you know, in the back of their minds, ever thought about that piece of real estate 35 miles northwest of Jerusalem where 200 million soldiers, now this is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob talking, he says he's going to gather the armies together, and it's going to be a big battle fought there, 35 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And I would say, for you Israelis over there, by the time you get 200 million soldiers 35 miles northwest of Jerusalem duking it out, I think you guys are going to be in military occupation by then, don't you? And furthermore, where are you going to get 200 million soldiers to come out here and fight that battle? There's only two places in the world that I know of. That's India and China, or a combination of the two. Not to say that there might not be some Russians or Indonesians or Japs or somebody else in there, but I'm just pointing out that as a general rule, you know, 200 million, that's a big bunch of people, you know. 200 million. And this God says that he's able to bring that to pass, and he's going to stage this big battle over here. And he says there's going to be so many dead bodies over there, take 11 years to gather up the bones and get them all buried. 11 years. God, that's a bunch, isn't it? Cleaning up the battlefield can take 11 years. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here. We'll be back with war right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the webpage. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. And remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And let me remind you that the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give out don't mean that the authors and publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, though, are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour editorial review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, it's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. 67. All right, we're talking about war. I'm not giving you a little introduction here from Mr. Smedley, Mr. Smedley Butler. Quite a little story. Listen to this. Some of the most famous people in politics have had something to say about war. You know, generals and statesmen and politicians. So I got a few quotations together, and I thought some of these quotations are pretty neat from people who actually were there on the battlefield and professional soldiers like this guy Butler. Now, I'm not a professional soldier. I don't know much about it. My daddy was in the Army in World War II. You know the big one, WW2? And most of our family, most of the Gordons, you know, at one time or another have been in the military, either World War I or World War II or Spanish-American War or fighting for the Confederacy. You know, the Confederates had a very famous general. His name was Bill Gordon. And I guess it's in our family genes to fight on the wrong side. You know, we're on the wrong side in Scotland fighting against the English and the wrong side in America fighting against the Yankees. But it isn't that the Gordons aren't warlike. The Gordons are pretty famous people. You know, we're part of in England or in Scotland. They call it the Gordon Highlanders. They've got a regiment, you know, in the British Army. So the Gordons are pretty warlike people. And we don't have any compunctions about going out and killing people. It's just that some of us, you know, start asking some questions. You know, there are times, you know, when you need to go to war. There's times when you need to kill people. But I'm sitting over here wondering, what in the hell are we doing over there in Iraq in the middle of this civil war going on over there? And the answer is pretty plain. We're over there fighting for oil. Fighting for oil. Now the big oil industries are people like Exxon and British Petroleum and these various and sundry oil companies over there. And I'm not opposed to oil, and I think we need more of it. But I'm kind of wondering about this thing of going over there and sacrificing your children on the altar of Baal to secure oil supplies when we Americans have more oil than all the Arabs combined. Did you know that? See, you've been told that America's only got 5% of the oil in the world, and that those Arabs over there, they've got about, they say the Saudis got 35% of it, and the Iraqis got 25% of it, and the Iranians, they got 10% of it, and then there's a bunch of other little states over there, they got the rest of it, and that the rest of the world only has a little bit of oil. I don't think that you people understand how much oil there is in the world. There's quite a bit. Up in Canada, there's a place called Alberta. For you Canadians, it's probably old hat, but for Americans, when I mention Canada, they'll look at you and say, Canada, what's that? And they think maybe that's a brand of tea, you know, or maybe a brand of coffee. Canada is a country to the north of us. Mexico is the country to the south of us, and Canada is that country to the north. And Canada has a big piece of real estate. In fact, it's about the same size as the United States of America. You know, you take a look at the United States of America, stretching, you know, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Well, Canada stretches from the Atlantic to the Pacific, too. And it's a pretty big piece of real estate. They got a piece of real estate there called Alberta. And in Alberta, they got tar sand. They got oil there. They got a lot of oil, and they call it tar sands. And they've been up there working on this tar sand. And until recently, they couldn't produce this tar sand and convert it into oil economically because the price of oil was too low. And that's because you can go out to Arabia and Iran and Iraq, and if you'll notice that when they're showing you an oil field there in Arabia, have you ever seen an oil well pumping in Arabia? Have you ever seen one of those jacks, you know, that's pumping up and down like they've got in Texas, you know, and it looks like a great big grasshopper and it's kind of moving up and down? That's called an oil well. That's a pump jack, you know, and they're pumping oil out of the ground. Have you ever seen one of those in Iraq? Think about it now for a minute, because they don't have those over there. And the reason is that when they poke a hole in the ground, the oil comes out under pressure, lots of pressure, 1,600 pounds of pressure, 1,600 pounds. Boy, that's high pressure, 1,600 pounds. And they've been doing that over there now since 1938 in Saudi Arabia. They poke a hole in the ground, the oil comes out, and they get a lot of it. Now, that's pretty inexpensive oil, wouldn't you say? Whereas in Texas, they poke a hole in the ground, and except for a few gushers they had down there that were under pressure, they got to pump the oil out of the ground. And it takes 17% of all the oil that they pump out of the ground to pump the rest of the oil out of the ground. So it takes 17% of the oil to get the other 83% to the oil refinery so they can refine the gasoline for your car. So over there in Arabia, they get 100% out of the ground. It doesn't cost them anything. Don't have to pump jack squat. Isn't that just special? All right. Now, up in Alberta, they got to bring in big, heavy machinery. And they got to move all of this sand, and then they got to extract the oil out of it, and then they got to dispose of the sand. And it's a pretty costly process. And they tell us it costs about, $30 a barrel to produce oil that way. Well, when oil is priced at $70 a barrel, that's a $40 profit per barrel. Not as good as in Saudi Arabia, where they get a barrel out of the ground, they get $70 of profit. But 40 bucks isn't too shabby, you know, for a bunch of wild men to the north. And they're happy with that 40 bucks over there, so they're starting to produce more and more of that. Well, did you know how much they got up there in Canada? Yeah. They think they got 3 trillion barrels. 3 trillion. Now, that's a bunch of oil. That's a bunch of oil. But I'll put that in perspective for you so you can see why we're going to war and what we're fighting over. See, that Iraqi oil is very valuable because when you poke a hole in the ground there in Iraq,
You get oil out of the ground at $70 a barrel, and you know you don't have to spend a whole lot of time in the Harvard Business School to figure out that $70 a barrel profit versus $40 a barrel profit. It's better to drill oil wells in Iraq than it is to dig tar sand out of Alberta. But for some reason, I don't know why this is, and I intend to ask God in the judgment. I'm going to walk right up to him and say, "Now, God, you know you're a pretty nice guy, and we love you like a brother, but I need you to explain to me why you gave the Arabs all the good oil and gave us all of this crappy oil in the tar sands." I'm going to ask him that. And that's because it causes so much hate and discontent. I mean, we're over there stealing these people's oil. See, these Arabs got they got the easy oil, and we got all the hard oil, the tough oil. They got the $70 oil, we got the $40 oil, and I don't know why God did that to us. And I'm going to ask him about that. But, you know, that's the breaks of the gate. He gave them guys the desert and the sand over there with all the oil. He gave us all the prairies and all the rich soil over here with the bad oil in it, and they've got easier oil. So we're over there stealing it from them, and it causes hard feelings. It just causes hard feelings. When you steal from people, it causes hard feelings. And you need to understand that, Americans. You're over there stealing those Iraqis' oil, and they're ticked off about it. So, as Smedley said, they're fighting for their homes, and they're fighting for their coasts. And you're mercenaries, and you're over there fighting for their oil, and they're fighting for their oil, too. So, you know, you need to tuck it away and keep it in perspective. Smedley, from 1900 to 1933, was working for United Fruit Company and Brown Brothers Harriman. And today, you military people are over there working for Chase Manhattan, and Bechtel, and Halliburton. The names have changed, but, you know, the goal is the same. You know, we're fighting for money. We're fighting for the economy, things that really matter in life, money. Okay, well, anyway, there's 3 trillion barrels of oil up there in Alberta. Hell, you people might have 6 trillion barrels up there. God only knows how much is there, but they've identified 3 trillion so far. Now, the world uses about 25 billion barrels a year. 25 billion. Well, you know, if you divide 25, now a trillion is 1,000 billion. Did you know that? So if you take 1,000, my calculator can't handle trillions and billions and quadzillions and stuff. So I'll just take 1,000 and divide that by 25. That's a 40-year supply for the entire world. You Canadians have enough oil up there. If you just took 1 trillion barrels of oil, you could supply the entire world for the next 40 years, never pump another barrel out of Saudi Arabia or Venezuela or Nigeria or any place else. You Canadians can do it all by yourself. And you've got 3 of those, 3 trillion barrels of oil up there. Can you believe that? Okay, and then to make matters even worse, we Americans are up there taking your oil and giving you our worthless paper, giving you our dollars, giving you this fiat currency for your valuable oil. We're up there stealing from you. You guys are going to get ticked off about that one of these days when we stiff you and don't pay you. And then you guys are going to be sitting up there wanting to invade America like the Mexicans and everybody else. Okay, now that's $3 trillion. Now that's just for you Canucks up there. Now you guys got a pretty good thing. But we Americans got something even better, And that is, we've got 3.6 trillion barrels of oil shale down here in the United States, and we don't have to dig it out and dispose of it. We can heat the stuff right there in the ground and get it out of the ground. I got a new technology, and we can do it for about $30 a barrel also, $30 a barrel. But see, the oil companies aren't dummies, and the oil companies are sitting there saying, we would rather go to Iraq and fight the Iraqis and take their oil, which is worth $70 a barrel, as opposed to going over here and working our tails off and sweating by the, you know, earning our bread by the sweat in our face, and we don't want to do that. And so they got our military over there fighting those Iraqis, and the Iraqis are over there fighting for something that they believe in too. See, they're fighting for their wives and their children and their honor and their oil. And they're taking it real hard. God, they're taking it real hard. And I don't understand why. We Americans are just over there trying to engineer regime change and bring you democracy in exchange for your oil. We want to share with you the same burdensome form of government with taxation, regulations, and controls and gun control that we have here in America. And we want to share that with you. We want to share with you the same kind of tyranny that we've imposed upon ourselves with the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and we want to export it to Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and every place else. And those guys over there are resisting us. Can you believe it? Resisting us. All right, kids, let's get down to the bottom line. You Canadians have enough oil up there. For you 31 million Canadians, you guys have got enough oil forever for yourselves. You don't need to supply the Americans. You don't need to supply the Russians or the English or the Japanese or anybody. Just keep all of your oil. 3.6, you don't have 3.6, you only got 3 trillion. You just take your 3 trillion barrels of oil at the rate you're using oil, and you people will have oil in Canada forever until Jesus comes back, and probably longer than that. And here in America, we have enough oil here to supply America for 666 years. We use 6 billion barrels a year. We have 3,600 divided by 6. That's a 600-year supply in America. At the rate that we're using oil right now, we could supply ourselves, just American, out of our own stocks, out of our own oil shale, for 600 years. But we got to go to Iraq and take their oil away from them because their oil is easier to get and it's more profitable. And we're overdoing that for Bechtel and Halliburton and Exxon and Standard Oil and Mobil and Shell and everybody else. Now, if that's what you want to do, I don't want to get in the way of your happiness and success, but that's the stuff that makes war. You know, I mean, it's just the way life is. Now, you Canadians up there are going to be just mad as hell when you find out that all of those billions and billions of dollars of treasury bills and notes and all the rest of it is just so much crap, and you're not going to get paid. We're going to take your oil and your timber and all of your valuable minerals, and we're going to consume them down here in America, and we're going to stiff you, and we're not going to pay you. And if you people up in Canada can't figure that out, then you've got to be brain dead. Brain dead. Which makes me wonder, as an American, what the hell are you Canadians thinking about up there? Now, I can understand you people wanting to do business, and, you know, you want to watch our movies. I'm not quite sure why you want to watch Filth and Perversion, you know, that we export to you, but for some reason, I guess you do. And but you know, that's just kind of dumb, you know, when you sell us all of your stuff up there, all of your timber and your oil and your nickel and your raw materials for worthless paper. I mean, you'd think, you know, you people up there would say, well, give us computer chips and, Caterpillar tractors, or, you know, give us something that we can actually use up here. It would seem like to me. Okay, now one of these days when we stiff you, you people are going to get mad as hell and you're going to want to go to war. And that's the stuff that makes war. And now the only reason that you Canadians probably won't attack us is because we got nukes and you don't. I mean, you know, think about it pragmatically. You Canadians, 31 million of you, don't want to attack 300 million Americans down here armed with nukes, now do you? It's kind of a one-sided program. Just thought I'd share that with you. All right, we're talking about war. And I'm going to be down in Austin, Texas, or at least I think I'm going to be down in Austin, Texas. Let me give you a little reminder here. I've had a number of inquiries about conducting a tax and status school down in Austin, Texas. So if you're one of those, why don't you call us here at the law school for a date and time? Remember, the number here is 417-273-4967. And we're thinking about September, October. You can send us an email, remember, to georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. If you're interested in our tax and status school in Austin, Texas, give us a call. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to wrap it up right here. We'll be back tomorrow night talking about this thing called war next time. Let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet, daily, worldwide. And for more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Okay, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tonight. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So, until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.